Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is former Environmental Conservation Commissioner for the state of New York and former president of the National Audubon Society, Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, human sperm count and chemicals in the environment. We'll meet some scientists who are beginning to find out what's happening to our reproductive future. Then we'll see how wolves are making their way into the upper Midwest all by themselves. Our ear to the ground speaks to Mahesh Chandra Mehta, an attorney from India whose many environmental cases include saving the Taj Mahal. And in our Earth calendar, we prepare for the emergence of the 17-year cicada. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. Variations in human sperm count are the subject of intense scientific debate. The debate has been energized by the recent publication of a book called Our Stolen Future, written by three researchers, Theo Colburn, Diane Dumanowski, and J.P. Myers. They argue that some chemicals which interfere with or mimic hormones and interrupt the endocrine system, and thus the reproductive capacity of humans and animals, are widespread in the environment and having an impact. One such impact could be a decline in human sperm count. Stephen Schrader is the chief of the Functional Toxicology Section of the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, and he summarizes his conclusions about the sperm count issue.
There's been three reports out of Europe which have indicated there has been a decline in sperm count over the last 20 to 50 years. Most recently, there were two or three reports about various cities within the United States not showing any decrease. And I think probably the consensus now is that there probably are some areas, both within the states and around the world, that may be having a decline in sperm count, but it may not be a global effect.
And why is this an area we ought to be thinking about at all?
Well, the human sperm count has always been surprisingly low compared to other species. If you look at a bull, for example, they have a billion sperm per cc, whereas in humans, depending on who you read and what the current literature is saying now, probably 50 million is closer to what we have for an average. And so obviously a decrease in sperm numbers, a significant decrease, could affect fertility of men. And
Schrader says there is no doubt about the fact that some chemicals which have been encountered in the workplace do indeed reduce sperm count and fertility.
I think the one that really got everybody started was dibromochloropropane, or DBCP. And that was a chemical, a pesticide, which was being manufactured in California. And the men working with that, actually their wives, talking amongst themselves, realized that several of them were having problems having children. And a study followed up on that and found that a third of those men had very low sperm counts, and half of those, in fact, had no sperm at all.
J.P. Myers, co-author of Our Stolen Future, describes why his team, which was considering the impact of endocrine interrupters seen primarily in wildlife, considered the human sperm count data.
Scientists did not simply grab endocrine disruptors out of thin air and pose it as a solution to the sperm count issue. Instead, in fact, it worked almost the other way around. The scientists who are working on endocrine disruptors, these compounds that have the ability to disrupt fetal development, they learned through laboratory studies and they learned through experience with people who, by accident of medicine or diet, were exposed accidentally to hormone disruptors. They learned that in some instances, in very predictable instances, sperm counts would decline if the male was exposed in the fetus. So this body of literature grew up around that fact, that experimental reality. And then we and others began to ask, if in fact we're seeing that pattern in laboratory experiments, in animal experiments, whose control of sperm count is not dissimilar from humans, shouldn't we be looking for this in the human population at large. And about the time that question arose, these remarkable studies came out of Denmark saying that based on current evidence in 1992, there appeared to be a fairly broad-based decline in human sperm count worldwide. So as the folks who work in the lab and did those lab studies looked at these new studies coming out of human monitoring, they found their predictions apparently confirmed.
Researchers say that attention deficiency, susceptibility to disease, and other reproductive problems may be of greater concern than sperm count as we consider the impact of endocrine interrupters in the environment. Lynn Goldman is a pediatrician, and she is also the Assistant Administrator for Prevention, Pesticides, and Toxic Substances at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. She describes the endocrine-interrupting chemicals that are of immediate concern to her.
First is the organochlorine pesticides, some of which have been banned in the United States, like DDT, aldrin, dieldrin, chlordane has nearly been banned. But we still have some that continue to be on the market, and I think one of the things we can do in the short term is assess those, reassess them in light of this new evidence, and perhaps take further actions to limit their use if it's warranted, if there's a risk issue. The other category of compounds is the dioxins. We know that those have endocrine-like effects. They are mostly present today in our environment as a result of incineration.
As we assess the threat posed by endocrine interrupters, all the experts agree there is no cause for panic. But J.P. Myers has some specific suggestions for you and me.
There are modest changes in lifestyle that you can begin to make that will lower your exposure to these types of risks. My family does this. I've got kids. I've got kids that I don't want to experience these risks. And so, for example, we eat low on the food chain. That means we avoid lots of animal fats. We eat fruits and vegetables in season. We eat a lot of fish, but we make sure that the fish that we eat come from places where there aren't health advisories against eating contaminated fish. We also do some simple things like we don't microwave in plastic anymore.
Our new awareness of endocrine interrupters raises questions about what more should be done to protect people and wildlife. We'll consider the options on a future Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley, and you're listening to The Environment Show. Still ahead, we'll hear about how wolves are returning to the upper Midwest all on their own. We'll meet the lawyer who saved the Taj Mahal in India. And in our Earth calendar, we'll prepare for the emergence of the 17-year cicada. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. Humans have been trying to manage wildlife since we lived in caves. For most of our existence, the management problem was managing to get enough wildlife into our stomachs to keep us alive. But later we had other ideas, and in the U.S. we spent a couple of hundred years trying to manage wolves out of existence. They were hunted, trapped, and poisoned so successfully that current management efforts focus on how the wolf can be saved from extinction and brought back to places they once were. But in one case, there is hope if we can just manage to stay out of the way and not interfere with the wolves who are managing to come back by themselves. Thomas Lally reports.
Although big predators are often associated only with the West, wolves, along with bears and cougars, were once found in nearly all parts of the country. Reintroducing these creatures to their natural habitat poses great challenges, but the wolves in the upper Midwest have come back on their own. Jim Hamill is a wildlife biologist with the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. He says the wolf recovery there, ironically, can be attributed to human inaction.
I think there's a number of factors involved. For one thing, the prey base in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota probably has not in recent history at least been as high as it is right now. white-tailed deer numbers for the last 20 years or so have been at fairly high levels across that entire region, and at record levels in some places. So you have the prey base situation. And then secondly, and in my view, probably more importantly, we are experiencing a change in the public's attitudes toward big predators here in the upper Midwest. The primary reason for wolves making a new stand in the eastern United States is because of an enlightened public. It is not so much a matter of a success in wildlife management as it is a success in the educational process that's going on in this country.
Even though this winter was long and hard, with cold weather extending well into May, the wolves came through just fine. Hamill says predators aren't too bothered by the weather as long as there's enough prey to go around.
Well, they appear to have come through the winter here in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan very well. We've shown another population increase from last year's levels to this spring. In fact, a very substantial increase. So it appears that they've done well through this winter. And we would expect that with the large number of white-tailed deer that apparently we lost due to malnutrition this winter.
Hamill says it's hard to quantify just how wolves benefit the ecosystem, except that they cull populations of animals like deer and rabbit. But it's easier to debunk their dangers. Contrary to Little Red Riding Hood, there is no instance where a wild, healthy wolf has attacked a human in North America. Yet their eradication by humans was carried out with amazing success.
The wolf was native to this state, was basically extirpated from the state, and now, since the early 80s, has started to make a comeback in Michigan. And in 1989, we knew of three wolves that existed on the mainland of the Upper Peninsula. And we just finished with our survey for this winter, and we're able to document the presence of 116 wolves on the mainland. So they're making a strong comeback.
Now compare this recovery to the recovery going on and causing quite a bit of consternation in Yellowstone Park.
Yeah, it's quite a contrast. The two recoveries, the Yellowstone recovery effort and the recovery that's going on in the Upper Great Lakes, is a very interesting contrast in methods of recovering wildlife populations. What's happened in the Upper Great Lakes can best be described as a natural recovery based on the animal's own initiative. And over in the Yellowstone situation, the Yellowstone ecosystem, that's based on the initiative of man to translocate wolves back into that ecosystem. Here in the Upper Midwest, wolves have expanded, established, and reestablished and recovered themselves in many habitats that they formerly held, you know, 50 and 100 years ago, all of their own volition. They've moved here all on their own. There have been no translocations of wolves from places like Canada or like from northern Minnesota to Michigan in the last 20-some years. So this is truly a natural phenomena that's going on here.
Hamill says the wolves of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan can probably support about 1,000 wolves, but it's the human population which will determine whether the wolves ever reach that number. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
You're listening to The Environment Show. Let us know about your environment. You can write us at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206.
Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, Mahesh Chandra Mehta, protector of the Taj Mahal and the Ganges River. A dedicated public interest attorney, Mahesh Chandra Mehta's first environmental case was to save the Taj Mahal. While visiting the monument for the first time in 1984, Mehta was struck at how this beautiful monument had become pitted and yellowed as a result of pollution. To prevent its further destruction, that same year he filed a petition with the Supreme Court of India against polluting factories near the monument. The following year, he filed again, this time against industries along the Ganges River.
And if we cannot save the Taj Mahal, which is one of the wonders of the world, and the river Ganges, which is the holiest of the holy rivers, and which is worshipped by millions of Hindus in India, I think that we cannot do anything. And for that reason, I filed these two cases.
In 1993, after a decade of battles in the courtroom, the Supreme Court ordered 212 small factories surrounding the Taj Mahal to close. An ongoing struggle, the case still continues. Today, Mehta claims he cannot visit the Taj Mahal because of threats to his life from angry factory owners. Despite this, however, he continues to fight against industries that create pollution. Over the years, he has won more than 40 landmark environmental judgments from India's Supreme Court, making him perhaps one of the most successful environmental litigators in the world.
Many industries in the process were closed down. Many industries were directed to set up pollution control devices. And so that way, a sea change has been made, but still much more has to be done.
India has laws protecting the environment, Mehta says, but unfortunately they are not strongly implemented. He claims this lack of enforcement entices multinational companies to India with dismal effects, like the Bhopal disaster, where toxic gas leaked from a Union Carbide factory with devastating results.
They are trying to dump these countries with hazardous waste and obsolete technologies, and this should not happen. There were many hazardous chemicals which have been banned in these countries. These are being manufactured in India and in other Asian countries.
Currently, Mehta is in the midst of a case where another industry is taking advantage of the weaknesses in the legal system: intensive shrimp farming along India's coast. These industries, he says, with their practice of intensive aquaculture, have seriously damaged the ecosystem and should be banned. Mehta says some people perceive him as always being against someone, but he explains this is not true. He is just for the environment at all times. Mahesh Chandra Mehta is one of the six recipients of the 1996 Goldman Environmental Prize, which is awarded to grassroots heroes from each of the six inhabited continents. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
You're listening to The Environment Show. Let us know about your environment. You can write us at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Get out your earplugs, because this year marks the emergence of the periodical or 17-year cicada, whose buzzing chorus can reach up to 100 decibels. That's as loud as some heavy machinery. At an inch and a quarter long, these insects are basically black with orange-veined wings and bright red eyes. Dr. Alan Sanborn, an associate professor of biology at Barry University in Florida, is an expert on cicadas. He says the sound is used by the males as a mating call. The first call is to attract the females, and then the song changes to a courtship call in hopes of enticing her to mate. They've been waiting 17 years for the opportunity. This year, the cicada will begin to emerge around May 15 at the southern end of their range and in early June farther north.
When they emerge, what you're seeing is the last of the nymphal stages. the juvenile stages of the animal. They go through many different stages underground where they will grow and develop while they continue to feed on the roots. When the environment seems right to them, it has been shown that temperature at a certain depth is very important in determining when the animals will emerge. When that cue comes, whatever it is, they then come out from the ground, crawl up anything that's vertical. Generally in the forest it will be trees, but they will crawl up buildings or fence posts or anything else that's vertical. Your car, if it happens to be parked near an emergence hole, that's a choice also. So the insects will crawl up onto something vertical, attach themselves very strongly, then they'll split the back of the exoskeleton, and the adult will then pull itself out from the shell. The wings will expand, it will harden overnight, and then it can start flying around as an adult. In the next couple of days, it'll start the mating process, and the generation will continue.
A native of North America, most of the 17-year cicadas are found from North Carolina to Connecticut. Usually a handful of adult cicadas emerge each year in a given area, but they're not the 17-year variety. The 17-year cicada synchronizes its emergence so they all come out at once. According to Sanborn, there can be more than 3 million cicadas to 1 acre. But why does it take so long? Sanborn offers some insight.
There are several hypotheses as to why it takes so long for them to grow. One of them is predator avoidance. By having such long life cycles, it's thought that no predator can count on the cicadas as a food source, and therefore it allows more cicadas to live. Another possibility is that since they do feed on the xylem fluid, this is a very nutritionally poor solution, and it may just take them that long to grow.
Once they've emerged, mating begins immediately because they survive for only 3 or 4 weeks as adults before they lay new eggs. Sanborn says that although their life as adults is short-lived, they play an important role in the ecosystem during that time.
The match cicada represents a food bonanza for all potential animals that eat insects in that habitat. Again, the only real damage they will do comes about through the overposition, but in terms of natural place in the environment, that damage to the trees actually is a pruning. So the tree is actually better off the next year, because if it did get damaged through the overposition process, those branches will be pruned off, and therefore the tree will be better the next year. The insects will be food for pretty much any animal that eats other animal systems. It's a very important food source for birds. There has been some research to show that birds will change their foraging habits. For instance, if they normally forage out in the swamps, they will change and work their way into the forest so they can take advantage of the large numbers of cicadas that are out. It's also been shown that birds can have a greater number of offspring, and they can actually have an additional brood in years when the magic cicada are out. So birds actually benefit enormously in reproduction because they can have a larger number of offspring when the periodical cicadas are out. Fish will eat them, snakes will eat them, turtles, mammals, pretty much anything that eats meat will go ahead and eat the periodical cicadas.
Although the cicada density might seem overwhelming, Sanborn urges us not to be afraid, as were the pilgrims who thought they were the plague of locusts. In fact, he says they can be a good snack if you prefer to taste them rather than to listen to them. But if you don't like to eat bugs, enjoy their song, because you don't hear it that often. Just think, if your housemate who sings in the shower only did it once every 17 years, you could enjoy that too. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for program number 332. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Our Earth Calendar story was written by Stephanie Goishman. Thomas Lally is the producer. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.